I think the danger is that you think if you work harder and longer, this is what your parents told you, that you'll make more money, but all you'll do is get tighter and sicker, right? Did I achieve a lot? Yeah, I achieved a lot. But I look back and think, well, what was that for nothing?
Welcome to Upon Arrival, a show that uncovers stories and strategies that make up all the moving parts of business events tourism with me, Adelaine Ng. If you could give yourself a rating out of 10 for your ability to pivot your work or source of income, what number would you give yourself? Or how much would it upset your world if you suddenly lost your business? My guest this week is John North. John's had to pivot multiple times when things kept crashing and burning through no fault of his own. By necessity, he's transitioned to a serial entrepreneur, digital marketing strategist, app developer, and written 7 number one best-selling books along the way, including Startup Secrets, the inspiration for this interview, where he outlines 5 steps to fast-tracking from idea to a business. We'll tell you how to get a free copy of the book too, so stay tuned. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, first up, can I say I just love your book, Startup Secrets. I'm not done reading through it yet, but I love the straight talk that's in it. And it's such a practical book for the startup journey. I thought I'd let you know that.
Cool. That was the plan. So glad we worked.
But I have looked forward to this chat. We've all been hearing about the great resignation, people supposedly leaving their jobs in droves because they're reassessing their lives during the pandemic. I mean, it's a little debatable about how much of that is happening outside America, but there's also talk of this other movement happening, probably the flip side of the coin, which is that more people are starting up their own thing. And I can imagine that people in the business events tourism industry who have been so hard hit during COVID are in that camp. I mean, 2 years of being forced to think, what else can I do? How can I pivot? Will my idea work? So lots of questions, but I think start with helping us get to know you and your story a little bit better. You've been at this startup game a long time. How did your entrepreneur journey begin?
Well, it's actually quite funny because when I was a kid, like I lived on this railway siding, so a population of like 3 people or 5 people, something like that. And so I had a lot of time on my hands and I started my own little business because my mother had a post office, and so an official post office back in the day. And basically they'd people come and buy their stamps, all that sort of stuff. We even ran an exchange, like the old party line stuff. But they'd come and buy stamps and stuff. And so I started selling chook eggs because we had a lot of chooks. So we had like getting a few dozen a week. So I was selling chook eggs.
That's chicken for our American friends. Yep.
Yeah, chicken. And so it was going really well until Mum one day says to me, oh, I think you should be paying for some of the feed for these chooks, right? Because, you know, you're basically making 100% profit. And so I made a decision to stop it then because I couldn't be bothered paying for it. And it's like quite interesting when you can sort of think back at it. But I used to run like imaginary businesses and all sorts of stuff when I was a kid just because I had nothing better to do, right? So. And then I started working in a bank, for about 12 years. And at some point I sort of started this side business where I was selling accounting software, and it was like a nice little earner, and I took a whole month off once to work and I got about $2,000 or $3,000. This is like 20 odd years ago. I was made $2,000 or $3,000 in 1 month. That's a lot of money. It was almost twice, 3 times more I'd earn in a salary. So started opening, you know, getting more and more side business, couldn't cope with it in the end, and said, I'll quit. I'll start my own business. And so we started sort of selling accounting software and then selling all these other things. So people come along and go, can you get a scanner? Can you get this? Can you get that? So keep on selling more stuff. I had a deal with a computer company called Osborne Computers, which just gave me like 100 leads a week. And so it was really good. I didn't have to do any marketing, just answer the phone and, you know, good close rates and stuff like that because most people didn't have anything else. Then they went broke. Osborne went broke on me, right? So suddenly nothing. No leads, the whole thing dried up. And I realized I need to learn about marketing. And I hadn't really learned about marketing properly because, you know, in the bank, you don't really get taught about marketing. And so I spent like $100,000 over the next couple of years learning marketing, but from people who were doing it, not going to like uni and stuff like that, but actually going and buying marketing courses. Some were good, some were bad, some were really bad. And that was really, the internet wasn't really good back then. So most of the stuff was physical. I just finished scanning a big stack of stuff to get rid of it the other day because there's so much physical stuff, right? And I started getting sales. It got us to number one accounting, Pastel Accounting it was back in the day, got us to number one in Australia. And then I basically ended up and long story short, ended up being the CEO of the Pastor Accounting Software in Sydney. So I actually moved from Cairns to Sydney to become the CEO because they were their CEO was leaving. What I didn't realise when I joined was they were in really big trouble. Like they were losing 30, 40 grand a month. They were losing more money than I was. And basically they were, and I had to turn them around. So all that information I learned over that time, I said, okay, let's use my marketing knowledge that I learned. Let's get this, fix this thing up. And one of the things that I'm big on is recurring income, which most people don't think about. How can I introduce recurring income on business, right? And so we built this cover system for accounting software where you could buy upgrades on a monthly basis. And this is before anybody in Australia had ever invented it. And within 6 or 12 months, all these competitors were doing it. But it turned it into $1 million worth of recurring income per year on this business. So we ended up going from number 18 to number 2 in the world for Sage at the time because they bought it out to actually allow us to actually be the biggest, one of the biggest sellers of the software in the world because of recurring income. So every time I got out of bed every morning, money would come into the bank and we get like 100 grand every month just automatically. And so it sort of taught me a lot about marketing because I say, okay, what can we do to implement this? So turn it from a loss-making business, implement recurring income, make a win. And then long story short, I had to actually sell that business because they decided they wanted it back because they didn't want it at the time. I took it off their hands. And then after 3 years, they go, well, we want this business back. So that made me basically give it up. And then I started my own marketing business. So I thought I'll do this marketing for people. And I was going to get 20 clients. And what I realized was so hard, like to actually do all this work and thankless job too, by the way, doing other people's marketing for them. And so what happens was we couldn't cope. It was just too much work. And I thought, book publishing, that's interesting. Let's publish a book first and see whether the book can do the marketing for them. And that's where we started doing book publishing. And eventually ended up in developing software again. So I've come full circle from actually doing everything else but software, 10 years later coming back to doing software. So I must like software, I guess. But what I realized was the same principles apply. And I think the trouble with people nowadays is they overcomplicate marketing. Right, they start thinking about all these things you're going to do. The reality is if you don't get the core part right, that you can convert a customer at the other end as well, which I find a lot of people don't do. They do all this marketing. They forget that they can't convert a customer. They haven't done a proper sales process. Half the time you can't even get a quote done. And all these things don't happen at the other end. And so to me, nothing's changed in 30 years. They've all got the same exact problems I had when I was selling accounting software to these businesses that didn't have any digital or any computers virtually at all. When I first started working with people, they might have done a bit of word processing, a bit of spreadsheeting. That was it, all right? Today, nothing's changed. It's all the same thing, right? Spend all your time with social media instead. So I think the biggest problem is it's the basics, right? So when I wrote that book, I'll go, just give you the basics, do that, get it working. If it works well, then start working on it, get more detail, get more complicated. But if it doesn't work, fail fast and move on to the next thing. Don't keep playing away to something that's not working for you.
I love that. And that was as many twists and turns for a blockbuster, I think.
Exactly.
you could do a movie of your life.
Yeah, I could write a movie. Like the whole night. So we had a seven-year war with my supplier, a seven-year war, and it had twists and turns and all sorts of things. We could have been our own mini-series back then. Reality TV wasn't really big back then, but I reckon we could have been our own reality TV show. Some of the stuff that happened in that period of time. I rang him up once and I said, do you know that I've checked the ATSIC website, which is the Australian Securities Commission, so it's like SEC or whatever it is in America, Better Business Bureau, all the things you're allowed to do. And I said, do you know what? I've gone through the 9 things you're not allowed to do and congratulations, you guys have done all 9 of them. And I listed them. I said, you've done all 9 things against me in Australia. And it's like crazy. So that's a whole book in itself. I'd probably get sued if I wrote that book.
Wow, multiple pivots you've had to make. I mean, that was the kind of P word, which I think people got kind of tired of and in the end thought, please, whatever you do, do not say that P word. You've had multiple iterations of that. And yet you seem to be like this person who just kind of was able to recalibrate quite quickly, get back on your feet. I mean, it sounds like you're the poster boy for a successful entrepreneur story, but you've definitely had some bumps in that road. When you look back at those bumps, I mean, if you had to do it all over again, what do you think you've learned the most from your failures?
I think a couple of things is own your own brand. We never owned our own brands. The business that I had to sell cost me $1 million to lose that business. It cost me $1 million in 1 year. And the reason why it cost me all that money is I didn't own my own brand. I was a distributor and they owned the brand and they owned the customers, right? So I didn't own the customers, I didn't own the brand. This does sound a bit like Facebook, doesn't it? Right? All right. And so they could just wipe me out. They wiped me out eventually because they could just cut supply and that was the end of me. So that was one very important thing. The other thing too is I realized your suppliers are smarter than they think you think they are, right? And so some people think that they can get away with it. So my biggest problem was, as a distributor, if we became too successful, we put a head up too high and became a tall poppy, as Australians call it. If we weren't that successful, we'd get cut out. They'd shut us down because we weren't making enough sales. You had to be reasonably successful to be able to do it, but not too successful. So as soon as we became a tall poppy, we became a target. And I think that's what happens in small business too. As soon as someone becomes famous, particularly in Australia, I think it's probably less in America, which is probably a good thing in America, but in Australia, you become too popular and too famous, you can almost guarantee that someone will pull you down back into the yabby pot, right? So they just pull you back in. Because the reality is they don't want people rising above themselves. Australia's a very different kind of culture in business. And, you know, I had a lot of clients back in the day that had fancy cars and they would park them down the street that people didn't see them to pull up because that would cause all sorts of problems. And so I think that's the perception, right? And so to me, perception was their reality. And make sure that you own your own stuff, you own your own brand. You don't end up in a situation where you can't change the rules, because the biggest thing in a small business or any business is 80% of the problems in a business is you. You're the problem, right? Inside your business, you can guarantee that 80% of the problems are related to whatever you're doing, whether personally or by staff or whatever, the customers. You've got control of all that if you've got control of all that. And you can change it. And that's what we did with pivoting. We just said, okay, well, let's just start another business, right? And we got very good at starting new businesses, and I could start a new business in a week, right? Most people take a year to think about it. It's like, no, I'm just do it in a week, right?
Actually, that's a really difficult thing, trying to read the culture and, you know, knowing that balance. When is it, you know, you're riding on that dangerous line of being vulnerable to being cut down because people think you're too tall a poppy now, you deserve to be. And it's a really interesting thing in, I guess, Australian culture, because over the pandemic, we've seen how un-Australian we've become.
Yes.
So things like ratting on your neighbor. I mean, here we call it dobbing on your neighbor. We've seen that happen, you know, with the mask mandates, et cetera. And that's something that was inconceivable just a couple of years ago. So the culture's changing.
Considering we all come from, you know, backgrounds of being criminals, right? The whole Australia originally was a bunch of criminals got dumped off and go, yeah, we'll get rid of you, right? I've worked out my family tree. I came over after World War II, my mother. But I think the biggest problem with the pandemic is it brought out this thing that they said, oh, we're all this together. No, we're not. Everybody was every man for himself, right? And you think about that's typical human nature until it gets so bad that they have to, right? So most humans will go for themselves, save themselves first, and then worry about someone else later. That's the vast majority.
How does that translate, you think, into the tall poppy syndrome in Australia? Does that mean that we're now even more than ever eager to bring down someone that we've seen is really successful? I mean, what's your reading of that?
I think the biggest problem, and I think at the end of the day you've got to blame social media for this to a degree, is that, and particularly like the whole Americanization of the world, right? So America is a very different kind of mindset, and I think it's a good thing. Like you look at California, it's a big area for like entrepreneurs and stuff like that, and they're respected and they're sort of held up. And I think the biggest thing in Australia is that's never been the case. Like if you were successful, the people were jealous of you and they wanted to pull you down for whatever reason, and that's slowly changing. So I think that is changing. I think that's a good thing because I think entrepreneurs, generally speaking, make things better, all right? They employ people, they improve things. You know, their whole mindset is not to do bad stuff, it's to do good stuff. But I think the biggest problem with COVID, I think, has made people think about themselves more, and this whole great resignation is a good example of that, right? I don't want to go to work anymore. I've just realized how, you know, valuable life is and how short life is. So I think the whole world has suddenly got hit in the back of the head, I call it. Because every so often you need to be hit on the back of the head and go, wake up to yourself, right? And most of the time, universe will deliver that belt on the back of the head. Usually, whether you get the sack or, you know, something bad happens to you, have an accident. Like I had an accident in the same place with different trucks within a year of each other. And both times it was because I was tired. Like, yeah, it wasn't my fault this truck tried to kill me. But the reality was that I put myself in a bad situation because I was probably tired. I was doing too much, right? So that's a thump on the back of the head. Luckily, I'd, you know, survived the thump of the back of the head. Some people don't. So I don't know. I think it's, I think COVID brought out the worst in a lot of people. I think people have got to get back to, you know, thinking about your neighbours and yeah, if your neighbours, like I remember there was a story which I thought was ludicrous at the time where the police had raided this house and caught some young kids playing computer games in their garage. Because of COVID, they weren't supposed to be there. Five kids or whatever got rounded up and arrested because they were playing computer games and they shouldn't have been together. And to me, that was like, is this the world, this is what the world's come to, right? Is that we're actually like raiding someone because they're playing computer games? Like, that's just, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Just me.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm also really interested to see or observe how this is impacting the entrepreneur mindset. And it's interesting, the thing that you brought up about the Americanization of the world. I mean, that's to a degree been true forever for a long time.
Well, yeah, but streaming TV changed that, I think, because we're only given a small diet of American TV. Now we get all of it.
Through social media, yes.
And through social media, through Netflix, all those online streaming people. Previously, whatever the TV channel served up to us was pretty much what we got. Now we get so much streaming TV and it's predominantly American, you know, based TV. You're getting the people thinking differently, but it's not the same in America. I've been there a few times and the mindset's very different. The way they work is very different. You can't apply the same principle here that you can there.
Explain that. I mean, how does that work differently? Because there are also a number of American entrepreneurs who would like a slice of the pie in Australia and they've just found that the culture is just so different. What do you think it would need to take this to the next level, I guess, you know, become international and they're exploring countries like Australia, New Zealand, Asia, and the mindset is just so, so different.
Yeah, most of my client base is in America, by the way. And so I think the difference is that two things Australians are different at, and this came when we're selling accounting software. So when the South Africans used to run the show and they'd come over here and they go, you're not making enough sales, you know, you've got to sell this, got to sell that. And a South African would go out on a demo or something for sell accounting software, they'd get absolutely eaten for breakfast by an Australian. And they'd come back with their tail between their legs, basically going, what happened there, right? And the reason is that Australians don't trust people anywhere near as well as other countries do. They measure this trust level. And so Australians are so mistrustful in comparison. So I can talk to someone in America and get a book deal out of them in an hour. I can talk to an Australian and that book deal could take anything from 3 months to 3 years.
Wow.
For them to make a decision. They feel they've got a lot of choice. They're basically not trustful. And so they're sort of dragging this thing out. Whereas America will just get their credit card out and pay, right? So getting money out of Australians is much tougher. And that's what I don't think they realise when they come here. They think it's the same methodology that people will just pay or they won't. Australians, and the fact is the Australian dollar isn't as strong as the US dollar. So we're paying 30, 40% more. So there's also that mindset that's more expensive. So even though we say that, you know, Australia is pretty wealthy, I don't think there's as much wealth as like is in America in terms of the, you've got a very low sort of socioeconomic area where there's a lot of people don't have a lot of money at all, which we don't really have that as much. But that middle class can't necessarily afford much. And I think that's the trouble. So you've got to be really careful of what you do there. And I think Australian mateship, banding together and being a community is a strength that we should play to, not play against. Whereas in America, it's like most everybody's for themselves, right? That's the way it kind of works. Whereas over here, we're kind of going that way too, and I think that's wrong. I think as a community, as a country, you need to have a common reason for getting up in the morning, and I think that's the problem we've lost. We've lost that concept of why we get up in the morning and, you know, what makes us different. And I think Australia's got a lot to offer for us. It's a very friendly country. It's a very safe country in comparison. Everything works well. There's very little, you know, bad infrastructure, you know, proper sanitation and stuff like that. So I think, yeah, you have to sort of figure out that. And that slowness to make decisions and not trust you is very high in Australian comparison. Mind you, if you're a Nigerian scammer, you have no problem, right? Or you ring them up on the phone, pretend to be the ATO. Australians trust all that, apparently. You know what I mean? Like millions and millions of dollars get ripped off by Australians because they're targeted, by the way, by those scammers because we're easy. I think we're gullible. I think the problem is that the safety of technology is not as safe as you think it is. And so people sort of like assume things that are not right.
And that is just so observant of you. And I will just explain to those outside of Australia that ATO just stands for the Australian Tax Office, which a lot of us are very sensitive to.
Yeah, as soon as you hear the word ATO, and I'm assuming that over in America, as soon as you hear that, RS, or what is RS? They basically, as soon as they, they ring up there and you think you're in trouble. So it's automatically assumed that the person talking the other end of the line is really that person. And I think that's for fear factor. We're for authority, we're scared of them more so. I think Americans like to stand up to authority more than we would. And I think at the end of the day, like in Australia, you don't have the right of free voice. You don't have the right of a free opinion. You know, and you don't have that written down like they have in America. So it's a different, whole different culture, and you've got to look at the English background of that culture. You did what you were told to do. You didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
And those laws haven't really been changed. So if anything, gone backwards. So I think that's a difference, and there's a bigger cultural differences between what America's done and what Australia thinks about.
Yeah. I'm so enjoying going down this rabbit hole with you, but I need to get the conversation back to startups.
Yes.
We do know that, you know, most startup journeys begin with an idea. You call it the concept.
Mm.
And this is where entrepreneurs typically get excited and, you know, often jump into things without necessarily having all the details or systems in place.
Yep.
But, you know, you'll have those moments when you're lying in bed and wondering, is this idea going to work? Sounds like it's a really good idea, but, you know, should I pour in time, effort, and money? Because it is going to be an undertaking. Do you have a go-to checklist that helps you decide whether something is going to be worth it?
I think the thing is that, and I've been watching Dragon's Den on TV lately, and when you see those Dragon's Den, Shark Tank, and those sort of shows, and you listen to the people talk, and a lot of them have this misconception that when you've got a lot of money, you can make a lot of money. All right, so all I need is a lot of money, all right, and I can make this work. The reality is if you can't sell it to someone, you're doomed, all right? And so I think if you can come up with a concept and sell it before it even exists, you're doing well, because then you obviously can see something's going on. And so I think at the end of the day, you've got to prove the concept first. So what a lot of people will do is they'll try to build it and then they'll think people will come, but that doesn't work anymore. So you've got to be able to try and sell it. And I think if you can sell like 100 copies of something yourself or get 100 people to agree to buy something, then you know it will probably work, right? But what a lot of people try and do, they do it backwards. They try and build it all up, build all the marketing, and then try to release it. And then there's crickets, because what they've realized was their customer doesn't want that way, doesn't want the wording. So testing it and little bits at a time, and which costs very little money, and see if you can fail fast. So when we launch our customer stuff, we go, we want to see how quickly we can fail at this. That's the concept we go at the start. We thought about this new idea. We want to see how fast we can fail at it. Because if you go in that mindset, you're going in an experimental mindset. You don't care about winning or losing so much. You care about what happens. So if you can say, well, you know, that person, like the other day, a good example, I was talking about my software and someone says, oh, it's too comprehensive, all right? And so sometimes you can get your bum handed to in a plate, right, and said, well, basically, you know, you got the wrong idea. Doesn't mean it's wrong, though. Some people will just give you the wrong advice and assume it's correct. But if people can tell you, say, look, no, I don't like it, it's not good, you've got the wrong words, you've got the wrong product, whatever, that's what you want to hear before you put $100,000 into it, not after.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. In today's, you know, it's internet society, you can start a business tomorrow, launch of, you know, plenty of this fake products and the scammers anyway, but launch a beta test on something, trial it and see if it works, see if you can get attention for it, and then put money and time into it before you actually commit. And I think that's the trick that we've always done. We've only created a service or a product after we've had demand for it, that we can see that we could sell it. And what price can we sell it at? And all those sort of questions come into it. But first, you've got to see where you can actually sell it to someone. If you can't sell it to someone, you'll never sell it to someone. Some of these ideas will never work. You're just going to spend the next 3 years belting your head against a brick wall trying to make it work.
Yeah.
Because you were convinced it was the best product, the best idea. It was a great idea.
So when you say, you know, test the market first to see whether it's going to sell, do you mean you actually need people to put down money for it?
Mm.
Because what's happened what I've seen also is that sometimes you get people who say, that sounds like a great idea. You know, I can probably see myself using it, but you haven't asked them to park any money down.
Yes.
And I don't know whether that gives you a false signal sometimes.
I think it gives you an idea that people are interested. Yeah. As soon as it comes to the wallet business, and we say a lot of people when we do book publishing, right, people got opinions about covers and titles, right? So they go to their market and they go, "What do you like this title? Do you like this cover?" And their friends and family go, "Oh, I don't think you should do it this way." And the reality is none of them are giving you a credit card. They don't deserve actual opinion, right? So the only people that count is the people who give you their credit card or put the money in your bank, right? That's the only people that count in the end. Because all these well-meaning friends can tell you a lot of things, but it doesn't mean that it's even right. They don't even know what they're talking about half the time. They're just trying to protect you. So step one was get their attention, get them interested in it. Step number two, can you get the money off them or a commitment to pay or get a deposit for sure? So it's almost like you can get their attention and people like the idea. That's a good place to start, provided they're not your friends and family. Right? They're being nice to you, okay? If you can go and talk to someone cold and get their attention and get them saying, "Oh, I like the idea of that," that's step number one. That doesn't mean it's going to work. You still have to sell it to someone or at least get some people to buy something cheap. I think, you know, free advice is worth every cent, right? So you can't, if people say, "I'll give it away for free," well, that doesn't work because your next round of customers are not going to be free. You need to pay something. And so I think you've got to think, can I get the money out of them? How much will they pay? And I've always worked on a concept that every few years or so, double your prices, right? And so what it does is it increases your revenue, halves your customer base, means that you can make more money for less work. So the question will be, can you do that with that product that you just decided to come up with? Could you double the price, or are you going to be locked into a price that you never get away from? And if you can't do that, then you've got no scale. Like, look at Netflix as a great example, right? They were selling their memberships for like $10, $11 2 years ago. Now I think they're up to only $25. They've doubled their price in 2 years. But the customers didn't leave. They still paid. So the reality was people were still prepared to pay double the amount of money for the same thing, basically.
Yeah. You mentioned two steps, but I'm not sure if that's part of the five-step framework that you have for a startup success process.
No, because we had mindset, strategy, implementation, measure and review, and pivot and repeat. So number one is the mindset. You've got to figure yourself out, you know, because if you're coming in a bad mindset of something, then you're going to screw things up. Strategy, obviously figuring it out. But you can implement in a small scale and try to see if you can sell. Like, it depends on what you're doing, right? If you're going to create some sort of product that's got some sort of methodology behind it that has to be manufactured and stuff like that, that's a whole different ballgame. But if you're going to create a service or a digital product and something like that, you should be able to create a cut-down version of it or a limited version of it to sell it. And that's what you're trying to do, is get that feedback from people at the early days before you go and do too much. Before you write that entire course and think it's all great, you need to be able to get people to give you feedback along the line. Can you build it as you go? Can you get paid to do it as you go? Like I say, a lot of people create a course or a membership, get people to sign up for it, and then create it with them. That makes it a lot easier because you'll get a heap of feedback about it then, and you'll, by the end of it, you'll understand what they want, what they need, as far as trying to do it in isolation, trying to think what you think they need. Because just because you think they need it doesn't mean they're going to do it.
Very true. Spoken from experience. But, you know, through...
Yes. Probably losing a lot of money on bringing stuff out that we thought was really great, and then crickets when we launched it.
Well, but, you know, through your book, you've almost made that a paint-by-numbers process.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, how long does it take to do this properly? I mean, you've got a few variables, but are we talking months, years? I mean, can it possibly be years? Is it true that if you also buy a program or get a coach or a mentor, all the parts will magically fall into place a lot quicker? I mean, you've also talked earlier about buying programs and, you know, some were good, some were not. So take us through that space. I mean, how do you navigate that space?
I think the thing is that what I learned a long time ago is that if you want to jump ahead fast, go and find someone who's already done it and pay them money to tell you what went wrong, right? So at the end of the day, and if you buy the material, that's probably where you'll get it. And so a lot of times when I bought materials, some were good, some were bad, but I was trying to find the good in the bad, right? So I go to a presentation, think that was really bad, but I found this really good thing he said that was made sense. So I think the thing is you got to look at and you've got to be prepared to buy information and quickly, because that will give you a really fast way through things. And I think I could almost learn anything in a week that would take most people 10 years to learn.
Wow.
Because I'll just buy that information. And I mean, I think even Jamie said once about something he was doing in his podcasting was, this 20% of these things you do here will get 80% of the result. And I think that's what you're looking for. You're looking for that 20-80 rule where you can say, okay, well, if I just do this a little bit, will it work, right? you don't need to know everything and follow everything in detail. So I think number one is get that information, buy that information, get hold of it somehow to fast track yourself so you don't learn. So go into the bases you know nothing and you'll learn it even though you think you do. And then, because sometimes I can do this in a week, right? You can launch a product in a week, because what people do is, again, is overthink it. So I'm saying if you think that you could create a, I don't know, some sort of, say, a mastermind, let's say, example, you're going to charge $2,000 a month for it down the track and you're going to have 20 people in it and that's your business, right? And you do the math, that's pretty good recurring income if you can get to pay $2,000 a month, 20 people over the next 12 months, right? What are you going to do to get those 20 people? Well, you're not going to go and get $2,000 off them straight away. You might need 5 or 10 people to test the idea out on. Can I go and sell that for $500 and test them? Can I get 500 people that I know fairly well to start this up and do this with for $500? If you can sell it, then you're going, well, if you can't even sell it to the people you know you're going to struggle with this thing, right? So straight away, you know that you're going to change your approach. So you spent no real money except time to realize that you've got the whole wrong idea. And if once you've got the idea, then do it in small scale. Like, you know, test those people that, yeah, I'll pay you $500. Okay, I want you to show up. You've got to pay the $500. Try doing that first. See if you can get that through. Once you get that page through, then grow from there. And I think most people think they can run before they can walk.
Yeah.
And so I'll just spend $100,000 marketing. I've got this brilliant idea about this mastermind. I'm going to sell $2,000 a month. And you spend all this money and realize it's costing you, I don't know, $1,000, $2,000 to get these people.
Yeah, I think there are a number of people who've said, yeah, I've been there before and that was awfully painful and don't want to do that again. But sometimes we don't know until we actually try a couple of things out. But as you say, you know, the more we can speak to a mentor or somebody that's already been on that road, it's so valuable to be able to learn from their experience. And I'll just say also that the Jamie that you mentioned just now is Jamie Atkinson, who is a mutual coach of ours. And you mentioned the Pareto principle as well, which is the 20/80 principle. But you talk about starting with a clear strategic objective. And it does make sense. I mean, how will you know you've been successful if you don't know what that looks like and you can't describe it? Yeah, but what if you don't know yet? You don't know if you want this on the stock exchange as a measure of success or have X number of staff as another measure of success, because there's another school of thought that says, and you alluded to this as well, that you should just start and perhaps work it out along the way. So, you know, how concrete do you need to have your vision, your future vision statement set and clear as a goal versus when you pull the gun and start and go?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that it depends on what you're trying to do here, right? So when you go to, like, you know, I've spoken to a few people about Silicon Valley. If you go to Silicon Valley and you want a big stack of money from some investor, right, the very first question I ask is, how often have you failed at this? You know, what was your first invention? You know, what happened when you failed and what happened next? And if they say, no, I haven't failed at this yet, you go, well, come back to me when you have.
Wow.
And so I think the danger there is people think they're great ideas, what's going to work out. But when you look at a lot of the great ideas in the marketplace, like PayPal started off as a payment gateway, actually it started off as a add-on for some Palm Pilot. That's how PayPal started. And it ended up being a plug-in for eBay and ended up being its own thing down the track. So no way in the world that those guys would have realized what they were getting themselves into when they were trying to write this security plug-in for a device, right? And so I think the thing is you've got to look at it and go, what are you trying to invent here and what's the big picture? You know, what would it look like in 10 or 20 years' time if I'm going to stick at this? And most people think, I don't want to be doing this in 20 years' time, right? And so you've got to be careful what you wish for in some cases, because you could dig yourself in a big hole. So thinking about your lifestyle, what you want to do, what you're capable of doing without burning out, I think is the first part of this. So be look after yourself first. If you've got to spend 80 hours a week on this thing for the next 5 years, it'd be better be worth it.
Absolutely.
And very little is, right? Having been through that road of working, I realised you can't work 8 days a week, right? So as soon as you start working 7 days a week, there's no end to it. So if you can't get done in 5 days a week, you'll never get it done in seven. You're just going to be too tired. So you look at what you're capable of doing. And I was just reading an interesting book, 10X, and it talks about doing 10 times more effort to do something. And I think that's the thing that people forget. It takes 10 times harder to do things or get things off the ground you expect. So people think, I'm going to do this level of activity, I'll get a result. What they actually need to do is times that by 10 or 5 even, and that's how much activity they really got to do, right? And so I think if you can do it easy, well, then you can scale. But if you've got to work your guts out and you're not going to make a lot of money out of this for quite some time, then that's a real hard road just about to take yourself through. So I think about your lifestyle, your goals and everything first before you start thinking about what you're going to do, because, you know, you don't want to trade time for nothing. And then, yeah, be prepared to pivot and change it. I think that's the thing. And if you test a lot earlier and you get your head around what they want and understand your customer, then it's much easier then to decide what you're going to do with it. But I don't think anybody ever gets a great idea tomorrow and then it's completely exactly the same in 10 years' time, because none of my stuff I've ever started off that way. I mean, I started doing books because it was just an offshoot of the marketing and ended up taking over the marketing.
Yeah.
Right? Didn't expect that to happen. It wasn't the original plan. The original plan was this was a leverage to get us some marketing deals because we could actually help market the book then, so sell them a book and then do the marketing. Turned out being the other way around then. So I don't know. I think the biggest thing is nowadays a five-year plan isn't really a good idea anymore. Things move so fast now that maybe a 12-month, two-year plan is great, but you need that long-term plan that's much fuzzier in terms of what you want to do, but you need some sort of idea where you're going to be in 10 or 20 years' time as well. Otherwise, the whole world will just go straight past every year and you'll realize nothing ever happened.
Yeah, and I just recently heard a multimillionaire entrepreneur say that he's going on a three-month plan now because his one-year plan just didn't work. Things just kept changing so much.
And COVID changed the rules, didn't it? Like at the end of the day, suddenly things that you would never thought would have been possible or would have happened or even people would agree to now have agreed to it. QR codes is one of the ones that I find quite hilarious. Up until 2 years ago, most people thought QR codes were dead. That was it. Everybody tried. It was a great idea. It didn't work, right? No one really used it. Then suddenly they started using QR codes. Now everybody uses QR codes, right? Everybody understands QR codes and we'll scan the stuff, right? So I've started putting in our books now where we actually just put a scan code inside the front cover of the book. Up until then, nobody would ever use them, right? And I think that's the change and shift. And so if your business, you know, didn't use QR codes and could because it was really powerful, you don't want to be stuck in the thing of thinking, well, in a year's time we'll do that. No, you want to do it next week. You want to start putting that out next week to start getting some traction.
Yeah, exactly. Talk to us about pricing. Tricky area for startups because it's about perceived value, right? I mean, the first thing you do is look at your competition and then you say, well, maybe what I should do is to offer my prices at lower first because how will they know? I just need to incentivize them to try us out, but then how long can I go on that for? So when you're talking about trying to create a sustainable business, but also a business that stands out, and yet you know you need that income to come in to keep growing, how do you balance all of that?
An interesting story when I was selling accounting software and selling point of sale, right? And this guy said to me one day, and I had no idea about this stuff, he said, oh, start talking about barcodes, right? And I'd only really been doing this for a little short time and point of sale was brand new. So he started asking me about barcodes and stuff, and I tried to sort of bullshit my way through it, right? And he looks at me and goes, you have no clue what I'm talking about, do you? And I said, nope. No, I'm not. And he goes, you know something? He said, never try to bullshit through something you don't understand in sales because you'll get caught. And from that day forward, I knew everything about barcodes. You can tell me I knew every single piece. I went and researched the whole thing way before the internet was that good. But I knew everything. Each time people asked me about barcodes, I was the expert in that country, in watching that city about barcodes, because I was never going to get caught again. And so I think the danger here is that your value is undervalued. Most people undervalue themselves dramatically. So when you come to someone and says, oh, how much is your hourly rate? And they go, oh, it's $50 an hour or something. And you go, could you double your hourly rate tomorrow? And I go, oh, no, but you'll stay. I said, you bet you they will if you're providing value, right? And so if you can double your prices and keep all your customers, you're doing really well. But typically if you double your prices, you'll lose 20, 30% of your customers, let's say, right? Probably won't, but let's say you do. You're still doubling your price, still getting exactly the same amount of money. If you double your prices, you have to get better at sales, right? So you really have to get a little value. You have to understand the customer better. You have to do more to get a better sale at a higher price. And so I think people use price as a way of being slack in sales. Sometimes they'll discount and do lower prices to think that that will help them get more sales because people buy in price, but they don't. Because if I said to someone, you know, here's something that's $5, will you buy? And they go, I don't want that. And so, well, no matter what price you give them, they're never going to want it. They're never going to pay the money. But if you were, you know, trying to sell someone a pen for $5 and somebody really needed that pen and they had to fill out a form that's going to make them a lot of money, they'd pay anything for that pen.
True. Right?
Because they really want that pen. So figuring out what your prices are and prepared to increase them. And I think the biggest problem is people will discount. In some cultures, that's all the way it works. So you've got to understand that. Sometimes we might increase the price to drop it. So a lot of retail stores do that, right? They'll have a 50% off sale. What they've just done is increase the price by 50%. And so price is a hard one. You've got to make sure that just because you went and looked at your competitor's pricing doesn't mean that that's your price. And you don't want to be a race to the bottom. So the only time you ever do a lower price is if you've got a competitive advantage to be able to do that. You can make that thing cheaper than your competition and you can sustain that. And so if you're going to drop your price to compete and your competition can do it cheaper than you, they're going to beat you anyway. So you may as well just increase your price and make a good profit. And I think the cost of sale, that how much it costs to get your customer, is the unestimated piece, right? People don't think about that. How much money did it cost me to get that customer in the first place? And am I even making any money out of this at the end of the day? So it might cost you $2,000 to get a customer and you're selling a product for $2,000. Well, unless they get some reoccurring stuff with you, then you're doomed, right? You made no money, you just spent time on it. So, yeah, charge whatever you think a price is, double it and see what it looks like. So whatever the price is, the first price you think of, double it.
Wow.
And see whether you could sell something at that price. And you think, no, competition won't let me do that. Right, start coming down the scale and you might meet halfway, right? You might go, well, I might have sold it for 10 grand. I'll sell it for 20 grand. Now people won't pay 20 grand. Maybe I'll sell it for 15 grand. Now you're better off anyway.
Interesting. It's different ways you can, I guess, skin the cat, and it looks like a very different offer depending on how you've packaged that up. And it's to me so fascinating, the psychology of the whole thing and how this works. But really interesting thoughts, and then thinking about the lifetime value of each customer. But, you know, entrepreneurs also sometimes feel like they need to be in so many places. There's email, there's social media, there's video sales letters, there's getting on stages, there's networking. I mean, that sounds exhausting, just listening to that, just listening to myself saying that list.
That's how you're going to do that, right? Yeah.
Where have you found the most bang for your buck? And is it true that you do need to be in so many places in order to be successful?
I think the biggest challenge here is, and I think the social media is one of these where you've got to be on all these platforms. And I think sometimes you need to be on these platforms to own your own social media name, right? So that no one comes along and registers your brand name or something on social media. So owning those spaces is important. But then the biggest problem is, I see this a lot, right? Twitter's the biggest one. You go to someone's website and they've got a Twitter link and you click on the Twitter link and they've got 5 followers. And you go, okay, you've done yourself no service at all by doing that. And the younger generation is going to look at that and go, ha, you idiot, right? Why did you do that? Because what you've now done is said, I'm not very popular on Twitter, right? You've signaled it very bad. So the thing is that if you've got social media platforms, doesn't necessarily mean you should advertise to everybody if you don't have a decent number of followings or it's not set up properly, right? But I think the trouble is that humans are basically lazy people, right? That's the way we're built, because we're designed to consume energy and do as little as possible. And I think the problem is that people think that a huge amount of activity, you know, spreading yourself thin is going to make it work. But all you're going to do is probably make yourself sick, because I've been there, right? And so I think the biggest problem is you've got to look at it and say, what's the 80-20 rule, right? If I spend 80% of my time in this, will I get a lot out of it or won't I? And I think the reality is not. Like for me, LinkedIn is a good example. Having communications and conversations with people on LinkedIn, if I'm dealing with business people, is far cheaper and quicker than it is to try and advertise them in the first place. Because all I can do is I can go and find the people I want to do business with and start talking to them, right? So number one is go where your customers hang out and talk to them. Start there. Have a conversation. Because most sales, you need a conversation. And people don't want to have that conversation. They think, okay, if I do a big social media push, get them to my website, get them to buy it onto the website, never had to talk to them, all good. Well, guess what? Plenty of companies out there can't do that. And I mean, good example, I reckon, you go to the Netflix site, right? Or any of these sites that sell streaming. When you land there, the button you press on is to join up, get a free trial, that's it. There's hardly any of the reason to do business with them. You already know why you're going there, right? They already sent you there. You already know. Biggest trouble with a big, long website with all the stuff in is you've got to convince someone to buy something without having a conversation with them. And if it's a tight ticket item, you're never going to have that conversation. They're never going to buy it. No one's going to hand their money over to someone they don't even know for sure whether it's, you know, they haven't answered the questions. So think about the sales process on that. Figure out what's going to happen. And then, because I don't think social media likes equals money.
No.
Right. And I think that's a misconception that the social media companies wanted to portray, because the more likes you get, the more traffic they get. So for them, it's great. But a bunch of likes doesn't mean anything. And most of these influencers don't make any money out of their likes. And so I think you can look at it and go, well, no, I want to talk to the people. And my dream sell 100, something I think I wrote in the book, about figuring out who's your best customers and where are they. And in today's society, you can find them, right? You can find them easily. I mean, I've got some software that even does it, like a key in and just finds everybody that's in that sort of angle, and you can talk to them. Why spend all that money trying to get to them and trying to get them to like your page? Why not just go and ask them and have a conversation? Find a way to have a conversation with them. Find out where they hang out. Go to their networking functions or contact them, you know, ring them up. I don't know. But find a way to talk to those dream sell customers than is to try and attract their whole world, to filter them into this little list that they're telling you to do and spend a fortune on it trying to get there.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you've given us a perfect example of how you can 80-20 your business and just, you know, get maximum value out of your time. And that's where, I mean, I've heard it said that the cash is in the conversation. So sometimes it's easy to neglect the conversations that we need to have to create the business and just kind of think that we can rely on the emails and on social media to do the work. And that does, to a certain extent, you know, grow that know, like, and trust factor.
Yeah. And the basic sales principles apply, right? And that's what people try and think they can get past, is that people won't buy anything if they can just skip past the five steps to a sales process and get to the end and get them to give you the money. I've got to tell you that they go through those steps even very quickly. You have to get them through those process. It's a process you've got to take them through. You can't skip it. Because if they don't trust you or not like you, they're not going to buy from you.
True.
Right? Simple as that. In fact, they'll do the opposite possibly. They'll tell all their friends not to buy from you either. So, you know, you've got a situation where you've got to be careful that you're doing the sales process with that and trying to get in their head and understand what they're thinking is the trick. And I think if you can do that, you win. At scale, it's harder because you've got to build that reputation and pre-frame that traffic. So I read something the other day I think is pretty true. Only 1% of what you do in your business actually means anything. So the other 99% of the stuff you do in your business is meaningless.
Wow.
It doesn't result in any result.
Wow. Okay. I think we have to go back to the drawing board and really think hard about that one.
Wise man once said to me that if you're not spending 80%, if you're not turning over $1 million a year and spending 80% of your time on sales and marketing, then you're going to lose.
Yeah, that gives you some perspective, doesn't it? Because I do know entrepreneurs who don't want to do anything with marketing and they'll just outsource that part. And when things don't turn out in results, they kind of wonder why. And that's because it's not prioritized enough and they haven't taken the trouble to understand it for themselves.
And think about it at the start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. You admit to being prone to shiny object syndrome. A lot of entrepreneurs do, and my hand's up for that too. I'll do that course and that one, please. Yeah. And you say it's a big trap for many entrepreneurs. How do you navigate that space? What did you learn about managing this tendency that we can't seem to help to buy and often not have enough time to implement? I've certainly bought programs I've regretted.
Yeah, I think I've still got that. I think I'm still afflicted by it. But what I do, two things I ought to do now possibly is, so if I'm going to buy something and it's a big ticket item, so if I sort of set myself a limit, anything over, say, $3,000 to $5,000, that's a fair, reasonable big decision. Don't do it today. Wait till tomorrow. Sleep on it. It's amazing what the brain will do overnight to convince you not to do it the next day, right? Just by thinking, just sleeping on it. Like, I just want to think about it. I'm going to think about it and chuck it around for another day. If you wake up the next morning still pretty keen, well, that's at least then your brain's worked through it. You don't just sign up straight away and that impulse buy. The other thing I always make an agreement with myself is, if I buy a course and I'm spending a reasonable amount of money on it, I'm going to finish that course no matter what. So that's my commitment to me. So if I can't get enough time, so I haven't time to do this course, well, then don't buy it. And most people that I talk to don't have enough time. I said, no, you don't. It's not about not having enough time. You don't value it enough to do it. So people got all the time in the world. They just fill it up with stuff that they want to do, right? They avoid the stuff they don't want to do.
True.
Right? So it's not about not having enough time. It's that you've allowed other people to take up your time, or you're just not brutal with your time. And I think that's the thing. You've got to value their time to start with. So do I have the time to spend on that thing, that pretty shiny object? Or is it just pretty and shiny? I think I'm solving a problem. There's a guy I used to work with years and years ago who sold business planning software. He sold $200 a pop each time. It was $200 for this business planning software. And back in the day of faxes, he showed me this pile of faxes that he got for orders every day. I said, how many do you think are actually doing a business plan? He said, oh, probably none of them. He said, because what they do is they buy the process, the software, and they put it on the shelf and tick, they've done it in their mind. And they actually do the business plan. They never install the software because he got registration, so he knows how many people would actually register it. Right? And so great idea, seemed great, do a business plan, but when they get to the push, the shove to actually do it, the software made it so easy, fill in the blanks type thing, they still didn't do it. So I think you've got to make a commitment from your time and value your time and focus on it and get it done rather than drag it out. So for me, I'll binge it and do it as quick as I can if I'm going to do so. If I want to learn something quickly, I'll binge it, and then I can always go back and look at it later, but I just try and get through the best I can in that situation first. It's amazing how many books out there that you can buy for $20, which will give you the same amount of information a $4,000 course will.
Exactly. It's so interesting because I did hear somebody say how all he did was adapt his book, which is like a $20 book, and changed it into a course and charged $1,000 for it. And nobody really bought the book, but a lot of people bought the course, and it's the same material.
So, yeah, we do the same thing. Like, I've got a couple of things where what we do is we write the book and we turn the book into an audio book and a course, and we charge a bit extra for it because people want a different method. But the reality is the same delivery, right? People just don't spend the time to read the book. They want a visual. They want it to be sort of read to them. And also understanding how you consume information, right? Some people like to see it. They like to go through that video process. Some people can read it and they don't need video. So how you consume information is important too, because a lot of these courses you get are purely video only and no written down stuff. And if you consume information by reading it, you're going to get bored with that video course real fast because you're just going to stick to it. So I think know yourself, right? Know what you're capable of doing, and don't think that just because you bought this course, you solved the problem, because that's what I think people do. Course completion rates, apparently, are something like less than 10% of people finish courses. Less than 10%, probably like 5% of people actually finish courses on average.
Wow. I actually don't feel so bad. I don't think my rate is that bad.
No, but that's the commitment I made. If I'm going to spend this money, I'm going to commit to it properly. I'm going to dedicate time to it. Can I do that? No, I can't. Well, don't buy it. Just take yourself $2,000, don't buy it, because you're not going to commit. Sometimes those people usually got books about the subject, right? And I've always go and grab that book first and see how much you can garner from that book. I remember The E-Myth, right? It was a great, great book. If no one's ever read The E-Myth Revisited, they should, because in business you shouldn't be like mandatory reading at school. But that book, coupled with I spent a little bit of time on their course originally. It was like $2,000 a month, so I lasted about 2 months on that. 3 months. But that was enough to get me over the line. That was enough to get me to where I needed to be. Sometimes it's just 20%, but that was enough to get me where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I didn't need 100%.
But that's all you need sometimes in business. It's something that moves the needle a little bit more forward for you. And that matters, because it's a whole lot better than spending 90% of your time and effort into things that don't actually move any needles for you. You think you're working because you're busy, but not actually producing results. I wanted to highlight something else that you bring up in your book, and that is entrepreneurs often transition from being an employee to starting a business because they want the financial and time freedom that they think that they will get. And yet so many entrepreneurs find that they end up working even longer hours, possibly for less pay, a situation that you've described that you've kind of found yourself in sometimes. How can we avoid this becoming our story?
So the interesting thing with COVID, right, when people started working from home, this whole work-life balance thing went out the window, right? And I think the problem was that these people weren't used to it. You know, the vast majority of people who worked in businesses didn't know how to work from home. And so suddenly they were smashed into this situation where they didn't know where the start and finish was. And so interesting enough, what over the years, what I've realized was that when you wake up in the morning, the first question I ask myself is, how can I do more with less time? So how can I work 4 days a week and make twice as much money, right? Ask yourself that question every morning, see how you go. And so what happens is your mind starts thinking, well, hang on a minute, that means I can't work 7 days a week. I have to work 4 days a week. And you start working on your mindset, which is what we talk about there, right? And so I think the danger is that you think if you work harder and longer, this is what your parents told you, that you'll make more money. But all you'll do is get tighter and sicker, right?
True.
Because that's what happened to me. Like, I got stomach cancer, which I reckon was caused by stress, ultimately, even though there is a genetic mutation as well involved. But the reality was that I think it was caused by stress because I was working 7 days a week, 40 hours, you know, 100 hours a week. And so did I achieve a lot? Yeah, I achieved a lot. But I look back and think, well, what was that for nothing, right? It was a waste of time because a lot of these things I thought were important weren't. So focus on the most important things. See whether you can work less hours. Like, for example, I start work till 10 o'clock in the morning.
Nice.
So I get up between 9 and 10. I spend time getting ready to go to work, but I take my time and I use that time to kind of think about things and all that sort of stuff. So no appointments can be made with me before 10 o'clock in the morning. And at 5 o'clock, I stop work. And, I do other work after work, you know, bits and pieces, but the reality is I've got my mind, I'm stopping at 5. So now I've got a finite situation, right? I have a half an hour for lunch. Now I've got myself sort of stopped myself from being caught out because now my diary is now booked in. I book myself for lunch, by the way. I book out myself so I can't accidentally book for lunch. I've only got 6 hours a day. Now I've got to figure out how I can get that 6 hours and what I'm going to get done in that 6 hours. And the second part of this puzzle too is be prepared to do nothing. Spend a day and do nothing. Because when you're doing nothing, your brain, you know, you go away on holidays or you go and fly somewhere or whatever and you come up with all these brilliant ideas in the plane. It's because you can't do anything else.
Yeah. Right?
Your brain is starting to think out. So sometimes it's just think about the way you work differently and think about what's important. And what we used to do was we'd start an action list and write down everything you did every day in half an hour increments. So just spend a week, write down everything you do for a week and how long it took you to do it. And then look back at that week and go, what did you achieve in that week? And look at your time scale and you'd be surprised how much time you waste.
Yeah.
And so tricking yourself, right? So I make appointments. I play squash 3-4 times a week. I book for that. I can't avoid it. So you got to trick yourself into it. And I think you got to stop thinking that you can work longer hours. You got to work smarter. There's a book that I can't remember the exact name. It's about the 80-20 rule, but it's mostly to do with marketing. But it says, look at the 80-20 rule. So get 20% of the time you spend to get 80% of the result. And then look at that 20% and look at the 80% of that 20%. And keep going until you find the secret in there that's making you all the money and then do more of that. But you won't do that until you analyze yourself, right, to figure out what you're doing every day and how much time you waste on social media, for example, right? I decided one day I completely lost the plot one day. I was like, I'm deleting Facebook off my phone. And I never missed it. I never missed it. One day later, it's like, oh, I better check my messages. But apart from that, I realized that even though I was pretty good, I thought, I was wasting a lot of time on Facebook because it was like, you know, side entertainment when I shouldn't be doing that, right? And it's easy to get done on the thing that you like the best, you know, go and check in the footy match that you like to watch, all these things that you should be doing in your own time, not in your business time.
Yeah, I think Facebook has gamed us out.
I'll just spend 10 minutes and I'll just, yeah, and you look up and it's 3 hours later because they've dopamined you into it.
Exactly.
So I think distractions and being constant, and I think I read somewhere, 50 minutes is the longest anybody can work without interruption or break. So have a 10-minute break. So it's interesting at school, like when my son started working for me, you know, he'd be less than an hour in and then he would be wandering off. And I go, where are you going? What are you doing? And he goes, oh, because he's used to this break, you know, at school they go for a 40-minute lesson and then they have a 10-minute break but they change classes or something, right? They're used to these little breaks. And it's like, I said, no, man, you've got to sit there and work straight 8 hours. It's like, I can't do that. I'm too tired. I can't do that. It's like, you got a point there, right? So work 40 minutes, have a 10-minute break. You'll get far more done if you're on the clock. Well, put yourself on the clock. Another one that I've seen is actually put the clock on and give yourself 10 minutes to do something and actually race the clock to get it done.
That is hilarious how your son just brought his school rules to the work office.
Yeah. Then I realized it was a good idea, so we did it.
John, I guess, you know, a number of people are thinking, well, it sounds like a nice idea doing your own startup. Not sure if I'm cut out to be an entrepreneur. At the same time, they're in this industry, the business events, tourism industry, where it's been decimated for, you know, 2 years now.
Yes.
And I think you can identify, even though you've not worked in the industry, you can identify because government rules change the game, technology developments change the game, things outside your control change the game. And you've been in situations where the rug's been pulled from under your feet and your business a number of times.
Many times.
So you can identify with the feeling that, you know, a lot of people in this game are experiencing. So they're thinking things like, do I do something else and come back later? Because people do love the industry and it was just having its best years before COVID hit. What would you do in their shoes?
I think the biggest problem is if you've got essentially literally a government locking your customers out from you, that you can't even, like the cruise industry is a good example of that, right? They're not even accepting the cruise industry in Australia yet. You've got a problem where the government's locked your customers out of you. That's pretty tough. Like, I think the end of the day is how much do you really want to do that? And a lot of people fell into stuff by accident, right? So I ended up working for a bank only because I went to the CES with the local employment office, which actually was next door to the bank, and registered. And I was the only person in town that was smart enough to do that, apparently. So I was the only one who interviewed for that job. So I got a job at the bank because I was the only one interviewed and I hadn't registered. So I had no idea, no passion or anything to go work for a bank. And then I was there for 12 years. So I kind of got sucked into it, right? And I think a lot of cases is the question is how much do you value what you're doing? Is it something that's your passion? Because this is a tough ride to get through, right? So if you don't really, really want to do it, then you're wasting your time anyway, right? You may as well just give up shop and figure out something else. Secondly is what do you know that you could change? Like, do you know a lot of stuff that you could teach other people? Could you leverage what you do some other way? What are you good at? So I think a skills assessment and a passion assessment to start with before you dive into going, how am I going to get around this? And I think also the whole travel thing has changed forever. And I don't know whether it'll ever go back to the way it was. I don't know whether it ever will, because people now realize that they can go to a conference and not leave their house. They quite like that idea, right? You know, there's a certain segment of the population that do not want to travel, don't want to go through that all that, just to travel to an event. So that kind of concept of event stuff and people going, I think, might change. I don't think people will do it as much. And you've got Facebook Metaverse, who's lost $10 billion on creating a artificial reality, right? How close could that get to being virtual, you know, like a virtual conference? It can't be that far away. So I think there's a lot of risk factors. It's almost like you know, when the ice makers used to make ice, right, and they invented the refrigerator, which is apparently Australians invented, the ice makers didn't get into refrigeration. They just kept trying to make ice and they all went broke. And so I think you see that every single time. You see that in like taxi industry versus Uber. Right, they didn't change. I saw an ad the other day where the taxi driver, this particular term, has come up with an Uber-style app, right? When you've got an app for that, you can book it on the app and you can do this and this. I thought to myself, you guys should have figured that out 10 years ago. You've now suddenly decided that that's what you want because the competition forced you into that situation, because you would never have done it otherwise, because you quite preferred the idea of just showing up when you wanted to. You know, you didn't being tracked or measured or anything. It's just a taxi will come when it's ready. And so those people have left the gate open too long. They've now realised they've got to come and it's too late. So you've got to be careful that you don't end up in a situation where maybe your industry is doomed and you need to move on to something else before it's completely wiped out. I don't know. I can't see this happening. I can't see anything changing for a couple of years. And the biggest problem you're faced with is bigger businesses that can afford this. They can afford to wait. They can afford to ramp up fast. And you're faced with a little business, you're going to suffer badly in this situation, because they're going to ramp up fast, you're going to ramp up slow. And wow, that's the unfortunate part of COVID. I think it's forced so many small business people out of their jobs, out of their businesses.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether they'll ever survive them. Like, the big business will just take over, take up those customers.
Really sobering thoughts. Mm. I think there's still a lot of optimism in the industry, because where they have been able to meet face-to-face, get on a plane and actually see their colleagues, you know, and network with other people, they've really appreciated just the ability to do that. And they've said that nothing will ever be able to replace that. No amount of Zoom meetings will be able to do that. But this whole metaverse thing is also an interesting conversation. I mean, we talk about entrepreneurship. And I was, I think just a short time ago, hearing a story about a lady who was able to sell, she was selling her, you know, forgive the word, but flatulence.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Into these jars with rose petals. And she was making big money out of it. And when she got sick from doing her process, she decided to convert it into the crypto world. And it's still selling, you know, making her big bucks. And I'm like, if something like that can make money, I'm just thinking, wow, you know.
Yeah, I know. And I think that it's sort of a very indictment of the human society in some respects. But I think the end of the day is how much do you really want to do it? how much passion have you got for it? And I think a lot of the tourism industry, particularly event management, has got a wealth of knowledge that most people don't know. So these little things that they do within an event is very, very valuable. And I think figuring that out as to whether they can pivot to something they're really good at, wait it out, right, and then come to the other end. But all you need is this to happen again, which I don't know whether, you know, I don't think will ever for another 100 years. But I think at the end of the day, you know, people are very conscious of it now. People are very high touch sensitive. So you're going to have to mold your way you do business to accommodate people's fear factors now as well. I don't know how people are going to survive, but the biggest problem is that if you can't figure out something, and also with entrepreneurship, there's kind of two levels to it. One is, can you make a good living out of this and that's all you want? So it's not a scalable business, right? You've got to think about your reason for doing it. And I go back to Dragon's Den and stuff like that. But a lot of these businesses that go on there trying to seek money for investors is funny, because you're looking and think, that's not a scalable business. Someone can just copy that tomorrow or whatever. And so you've got to really look at yourself and say, can I just be copied? Am I as good as I think I am? Like, you've got to be real with yourself, right? And I think if you can make a decent amount of money and that's good enough in a lifestyle business, like, I think there's two sorts of business. A lifestyle business where you make good money, don't have to work too hard, and you can get the marketing thing working properly, then why not? Just do that. That's a lifestyle thing. Or do you really want to bring out a multi-billion dollar unicorn that's going to make so much money, going to be so wealthy you don't know what to do with the money? That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I think somewhere between the two. But I think the stress on small business enterprises is that they've got to be scaling, growing, all that sort of stuff. But I think they forget to say, well, what about me? What do I want? Because life is too short when it comes down to it.
And I think that's your point in your book as well, that the first conversation to have for your startup business is the one that you have with yourself about what is it that you want out of your business, and how does that serve you and your goals for your own life. So
No one sits on their deathbed and says, I wish I spent more time at work, I've got to tell you.
Exactly. At the same time, a lot of people have flashbacks about all the things that they regretted not doing. So you balance that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. I think humans do whatever they want. I think having regrets is basically the reason why you have regrets is that you learned something. And I think you probably wouldn't, if you didn't have that regret, you wouldn't have learned it. And then you can lose that and use it again, right?
Yeah.
If you learn from your mistakes. Some people don't. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're looking to go, well, I regret doing that, I regret the fact I didn't set up my own branding and all that sort of stuff properly when I took over that business, because I was naive. I didn't know that that was ever going to be important.
Yeah, but you failed fast, in your words. So,
well, not back then. That took me 7 years to work that out. Seven okay. years in colon cancer to get to that decision. Although I didn't know. I wish now, look back now, I reckon I could have done that in 6 months, 12 months. I would have come to that same conclusion in that period of time. But back then, I was bloody-minded about it and I was going to fight it. When I realised that the only option I had was down, like there's no way up. And once I realised that, that's when I got out of it. But it took me 7 years to get there.
Still better than 14 or 40 years, which other people do.
Possibly, but 7 years is a long time when you're fighting for something you realise there's no point fighting for.
Yes.
Because you don't own it, right? If anything I want people to understand is that social media is good, but if it's not your brand, and it's sucked people into thinking that they're, by establishing their page on their social media site and stuff like that, is a website. It's not. You don't own anything. You're just renting it. So you need to own stuff. If you want to build a business, you need to own it. You need to have control over the moving parts.
Really good reminder. John, I've so enjoyed this conversation with you. I am highly recommending your book, Startup Secrets. But if there was one book or resource other than your own that you would recommend on this, would that be the E-Myth book that you mentioned a couple of times?
I mean, I'm reading probably about 10 or 15 books at once now, so I usually buy them and just read a couple of chapters every week. Interesting enough, on evolvepreneur.club, we've got a bookstore. So every book that I ever find that I like the sound of, I put up there as well. So we do a lot of book launches, but there's a lot of other books in there that I've got nothing to do with book launches. Particularly on minds, you know, things like health and all that sort of stuff. So there's a ton of books that I like, but I think E-Myth is a good place to start. If you've never read it, you should read it, because at least they'll give you the foundation of what a business should be like. Even though it stood the test of time 30 years ago, longer that book was written, 30, 40 years ago, I reckon it's still true today that what that book says, nothing's changed. And so I'd start there as a start point. But there's a ton of good books out there on lots of subjects. Learn how to read fast, by the way. You can learn to speed read. which I did a bit of speed reading, so I was able to improve my reading speed by 20-30%. You can almost double it if you do it prior. You can read a book in an hour. So get better at reading books faster and read more books.
Wow. Okay. I guess I got to ask you quickly then, how do you read a book in an hour? It takes me weeks, months sometimes.
Yeah. So I did the speed reading course, and essentially what they do is, the idea when you read a book is you open the book and you're sort of visualizing as you're reading it down. What you do is you move your fingers down and read faster and fill in the blanks. So what's happening is your brain will actually read it all and take the whole paragraph rather than the line by line. It's a bit more complicated. The book teaches the course that I signed up teaches you how to do that. But the idea is you're actually moving down and using your whole brain to look at the whole thing and then filling in the gaps. Because, again, the old 80-20 rule in those books, right, they spend a lot of time labouring the point. When your reality's like, okay, pass that bit. And then I fold the things over, anything I like the sound.
Yes.
Right. You come back later. So, yeah. So don't just expect that you've got to read this from cover to cover every single word either. Like sometimes you can skip past things. Don't seem that important. So I think that's the difference, is don't just do traditionally way. You know, think about using that book as a resource rather than you just learn it and forget it.
That is definitely a skill I'm going to have to pick up sometime soon. So, John, thank you so much for that.
Speed reading is the most important thing an entrepreneur can do, I reckon. If you can learn how to speed read, I think you can get far more done. I used to have to read a lot of stuff because when I was in the bank, you know the test they do in the bank, they get two sets of numbers and they get you to go down a page and see how quickly you can do that. So how you can compare the numbers and mark when they're wrong, because in the bank they had to do a lot of that in the early days before computers. You had to compare and very quickly. And so it teaches your brain to kind of look for things.
Yeah.
And I think that's the trick, is if you can get through things quickly, speed read things and understand it quickly, then you save a lot of time.
Yeah, I would love that skill for sure under my cap. And that's something I'm going to have to work on. But John, how can people get more of you? How can they connect with you if they wanted to and find out more about Startup Secrets?
All right, so if you want to talk to me, connect to me personally, probably johnnorth.com.au is probably the best place to start, because it's got links to everything else. And then startupsecrets.show, if they want to copy this Startup Secrets book, like they can get a free copy off that page, or they can go on Amazon and they get a digital copy or a printed copy as well. But yeah, that's probably startupsecrets.show. And you can actually see the podcast show we did as well, working on the same principles of what we put in the books.
Fantastic, John. I've so enjoyed this conversation. I've loved that you are so willing to share from your experience, and yeah, highly recommend Startup Secrets. Thank you so much for being with us on this show.
My pleasure.
And hey, thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of the conversation. Let me know if there was something you agreed or didn't agree with in this episode. Email me at uponarrivalpodcast@gmail.com. Oh, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review this show if you like it. That would help other people find this show, and I'd most appreciate that. I'll be back next week to uncover more stories and strategies for a successful future. Till then, cheers.